read some of the early words. Charlie had a very interesting career, and he's still practicing science.
I got involved with the laser after the Ruby laser was invented, because I was at Berkeley at the time studying physics, and when I graduated in 1964, my faculty, Davis, told me I might want to go down to Mountain View and enter a startup company. That small startup company is called Spectra Physics, and we're doing interesting things, and Earl Bell was among those at the company working on making waves as his Charlie's career in science and administration. His brother-in-law, Art Shallow, was at Stanford for a number of years, and Art is the one who used a very interesting experiment.
Ruby laser,
that's a ruby laser wave container, using the red ruby light to pop the Mickey Mouse balloon. His way of expressing to a non-technical audience that the laser could do something special. It can in fact be used in the eye to weld the retina back in place if it became detached. So he has this statement, if I had set out to invent a method of reattaching the retina, I would not like to reinterpret that and say, the curiosity-driven research, part of all of the kind of research we do. First laser was operated by Ted Maiman in May of 1990. Ruby crystal pumped by a flash lamp that he bought at a local photography store. He put all of the elements together to make it work. And in fact, was ahead of his time, so much so that everybody who was anticipating the laser did not expect an outsider would be the first. Shallow told me one time he knew about the spectroscopy of Ruby. I had the opportunity of working with Earl Bell at Spectrophysics. Earl Bell was a non-PhD chemist, physicist, electronic engineer, and inventor. And he taught me how to invent the year I worked with him. The first really crucial invention he did was in NMR at Varian Associates. The second was the invention of the ion photograph of Earl Bell with the mercury ion laser that put out a laser. And immediately after the visible laser of mercury ion, argon ion laser, was invented almost simultaneously by Bill Bridges at Hughes Research Labs, Gordon and Labuda at Bell Labs and Spectrophysics, all in about the same 3 weeks. So now we have high-power laser radiation in the visible. Spectrophysics went on to become a very successful laser company. Meanwhile, I had learned that Tony Siegman at Stanford was holding brown bag lunches to talk about the latest research results. So I asked my boss at Spectrophysics, Herb Dwight, if I could ride my bike up to Spectrophysics. Certainly I could, if I made up my hours later on. So I took the opportunity and went up and had these luncheons. And they about the next generation lasers, about nonlinear. It was a very interesting way to learn about the research. I applied to Stanford for graduate studies and was fortunate enough to be accepted. And even more fortunate, I was assigned at that time our telephone labs. They were the competitor for everyone in basic research. I had a great time trying to decide how we could make the nonlinears, how we could pump them, how we might be able to make a fish. We were quite fortunate. A little bit of luck goes a long way. But on the way, we observed the noise of an optical amplifier called Quantum Day and photographed it with photochrome at that time, not digital camera. We were fortunate enough to have enough power in our homemade argon ion laser to pump a crystal and make tunable electrum. How fortunate were we? The threshold was 430 milliwatts of pump power. Our laser managed to produce. All right, we have a tunable source. What can we do with it? Well, one thing we thought about doing was to worry about making measurements of molecular species in the air pollution sensing. But about a few years later, I learned a lot more about a young man called Edwin Land, who had a process. And I used his quote as a way to challenge my graduate students to think about what they want to do for a thesis topic. Don't undertake a project unless it's important and nearly impossible. Appropriate challenge for a first year. They don't know it's nearly impossible. They know it might be important to you. So we began to look at atmospheric remote sensing, and that led to an invention of a high-power EAG laser for that application. Paul was held with Kill, did some of the very early analytical work on remotes using tunable parameters. Bottom line is that that became an international area for research. Allowed me to travel to Japan with Sunna Slonberg, and still active in remote sensing. Students worked hard to make our tunable source, old tunable source. Lasers in those days were not what you think about now. The iPhone I have in my pocket has infinitely more computer 8K of core memory, and you had to have control the stepper motors. That meant we could do spectroscopy in the atmosphere. We used a high-power, unstable resonator laser to pump the OPO, so we had enough energy. Atmosphere, Tony Sigma, frequency doubled, and the quantum ray, and we used it to pump the tunable. Quantum ray laser became a commercial product later on. And our remote sensing transmitter flashed our laser energy across the bay, and new methane. Water vapor, we measured humidity. We kept getting results of our methane measurement. It took a while to unravel the fact that in bay at that time were garbage dumps. Garbage dumps were generating Monterey laser, a 1 joule per pulse, 10 hertz Q-switched high piece to pump tunable pyramid oscillators. And that was five. My optimistic projection was that maybe in the whole world there might be room for 7 years later. About that time, I met Milton Huffaker, and Milton did so from a satellite platform. Using this day, we have yet to launch a satellite. Technology is not easy. Importantly, it's all the regulations that got to re-engineer lasers that meet a set of safety requirements. That challenge, the challenge of doing global wind sensing problem. We weren't the first to do that. The first work of Diapont Sunken Labs in 1960 used cryogenically cooled lasers. What happened in 1984 is that higher power diodes became available. And so all of a sudden, we had a pathway forward that looked quite reasonable. Our first laser was all about 1.5 milliwatts of average output power, not very much. Used the diode pump solid state laser to maintain a coherent laser radar and wind sensing. The element of that was a single frequency. Later became a commercial product, and in every U.S. So this very narrow line width, very stable local. I'll take a break for a minute and talk about a legacy of a laser that I is this month's IEEE Spectrum magazine. They hit the green light. First things it shows is a laser by Mitsubishi Corporation, diode laser, a neodymium micron laser, and a nonlinear chip called periodically cooled lithium niobate light. The same color green that I have in my hand. Why would Mitsubishi be interested in green? Well, they've introduced the first laser television, that is a laser projection TV. It's a big hit. It's a laser is a key part of that television. We at the same time, in my class, named Jeff Dixon, asked the professor Beyer, can we frequency double that low power CW needed in the ag laser, good efficiency, and get green? Jeff asked the question, I had the answer, I didn't know, I haven't done the calculation. I both agreed to go home over the weekend and do the calculations. We came back today, and we both nodded, yes. We had a way forward that we could actually frequency double a small low power YAG laser and generate green patent that was issued. That patent lasted a full 20 years at this time. 2006, the market. So why am I happy about green laser pointers? Well, it's a great pointer for giving lectures, especially if you're a color-challenged male like myself. When somebody stands up here and puts a laser pointer on the screen, I can't see it. I like green, I can see it. The green laser pointer is used for astronomy, and I'm an amateur astronomer, so at nighttime you shine it out and point objects in the sky. And my friends in the amateur astronomy club on the island of Kauai just love this little tool because they can show young boys and girls about objects in the sky. The rising application of this green laser pointer clouds above you is a very bright target to see and very easy.
If I get out of the way, my favorite invention and laser legacy because of its light.
All right, one thing leads to another. In science, you might know what the next step is. It turned out because we had a stable single frequency oscillator, we were invited to visit Jilla and meet with Peter Bender. And Peter dragged me down to his basement lab and showed me this poster, and this is a photo of Peter Heterodyne gravitational wave antenna. He was dreaming about detecting gravitational waves, particularly gravity. At that time in 1988, we didn't really know whether there were many black holes in the universe or only two. And Peter, being more optimistic than even myself, suggested that we would launch this LISA mission to possibly have a 1 watt green laser available. We thought about it and assured him that we thought we could. I didn't know a lot about space qualification, but
this got us started
down the pathway.
It will be shortly.
So following Peter's discussion, and NASA jointly agreed to do a study phase on the LISA mission.
Progress of the LISA technology.
LISA mission is slated to fly 10 years from now. It's always 10 years in the future. That's the nature of doing space missions. I think at some point it will be temporary. LISA will see waves from massive black hole binaries. We now know that signal to noise will be better than EB with a year of integration. Meanwhile, on the ground, was the LIGO Observatory, and it was talked about in 88. Then we need to move forward with it. Barry Barish and Ray Weiss are two individuals who really helped to put LIGO forward. The instruments have been built, and LIGO 1 has applied. You can see the difference between a LISA mission in space, which is a very low frequency, to LIGO mission on the ground, which is a higher frequency detector band. And LIGO detects gravitational waves, you'll literally be able to. Sources are binary coalescent sources. Now there's an international network, a LIGO interferometer in Europe, a small interferometer in Japan, promise of an interferometer, view of the Virgo detector outside of Pili. It's a French-Italian collaboration. It collaborates with the sensitivity curve. The sensitivity curve is the sensitivity of a strain measurement to detect. The LIGO community is holding its meeting this week in Southern California. All right, what are gravitational waves? Well, they're curvature of space-time, ripples in space-time. Why don't we see them? Why aren't they easy to detect? Well, that's the key. But they're extremely weak. The strain of space-time is only a part of 10 to the 21. I even have a hard time imagining how such a strain is, so I'll give you an example. Alpha Centauri is a star closest to our sun, 4.8 meters away. Detect a gravitational wave, I need to measure that distance, or I need to measure it to the diameter of a human hair. It is nearly impossible part in the next generation. There are many sources of gravitational waves. We know about them today than we did when we started on this. LIGO has published some 40 papers now. Finally, why is it so hard to detect gravitation? Well, one of the reasons is that the signal is buried in the noise. I don't have the luxury of moving my signal outside of the noise band like LIGO. I have to detect within. I have to find search techniques that work against noise. This is indeed a challenging measurement. The sensitivity of LIGO is shown here. We actually met the design sensitivity. To meet the years of data taking, and they celebrated at the end with a big cell. We did not detect gravitational waves. We had one chance in 30 to detect the gravitational waves in our. What are we doing? We're building the next generation LIGO. It's LIGO's designed to have to do that. You really have to be a smart physicist and overcome a whole series of noise sources. That LIGO requires new suspension and isolation, larger new test masses, better ways to support the test mass, higher power laser, spectral filters. But we get to use the same vacuum system that works. That was by design. So this is the world's largest vacuum system, about a tube that extends for 4 kilometers. Around that vacuum system, we have a protective concrete enclosure. We happen to have an unprotected vacuum out in the middle of the desert. So this concrete enclosure got tested, not by a bullet, but by a truck. Fortunately, it was strong enough to withstand a big bullet. And we didn't take out a vacuum system. All right, so advanced LIGO is going to be installed at the end of this year. It takes about 2 years to install the instrument, about another 2 years to go through and bring it up to operating sensitivity. Pretty quite a beautiful set of optics, of laser-illuminated optics, of alignment system elements. All of this goes together to make an extremely sensitive sample of the kind of. What does it mean when we're done? David Shoemaker, the director of the project at MIT, points out that advanced LIGO increases our range in space by a factor of 10. That factor of 10 encloses many more galaxy clusters. In fact, because space is more or less isotropic, the detection rate will go up by 10 cubed or 1,000. LIGO operating, we will enter the era of gravitational wave. These signals at the rate of about 1 per week. Very interesting time because space and the amplitude, not the intensity that we do with electromagnetism. For later this decade, a legacy of the laser will be gravitational. I'm going to close by rapidly walking through a power scaling argument that we've solid-state lasers can make high average power, and then I'm going to give a brief overview of the progress of the generation. So diode pump solid-state lasers from 2 milliwatts to 100 kilowatts. How did we do that? What innovations took place to get our range from 90? First, progress in diodes. There have been enormous progress in the pump diode sources. Today, you can buy 100 watts per centimeter from a diode bar operating at 60%. The HERO results are impressive. The HERO results are more than 372%. A little to go in power and efficiency. How do we make megawatt lasers? We make megawatt lasers by getting the heat out in a very reasonable way so we don't induce optical distortions. So Chernock, an engineer at General Electric, realized that if you remove the heat in a planar one-dimensional way, you can remove the heat and maintain high optical quality. All these slab laser concepts, dice slab, the face pump slab, or thin disk laser, early work on diode pumping slab lasers led to a 1 kilowatt laser in 1993. Did some studies for the LIGO project on how to scale laser power and realized that if we changed the geometry a little bit, we had a method to scale lasers to the 100 kilowatt. He turned out to be ceramics. Novel concept pursued in Japan by subtly adopted. So rather than making your laser out of a single crystal, we will make it out of a polycrystalline. Reason being, the ceramic is built in size to meet the requirements for power scaling. So, giving an example, Northrop Grumman Corporation was funded to build a laser more than 100 kilowatts in average power. They used the slab concept with diode pumping, conduction cooling, and they made a laser that was a master oscillator power amplifier. Laser is a coherent summation of 7 amplifier chains. Diode pumped and it runs continuously and it puts out a single frequency and a little worse than diffraction limited, but close to diffraction limited. This laser operated January 2009. Here's a recent article on lasers on lethal, showing the fact that this 100 kilowatt solid state laser will find a field later this year, early next year, and begin operating to do team of those who write science fiction, light that can be projected. Patients for this laser are out of corner. Of note is 20%. Of note is a 1 second turn. Note is adaptive optics are used in order to maintain. Introduce you to megawatt lasers because there are applications in science for megawatt lasers. Livingston plot a semi-lot of laser power versus year, and it projects that sometime around 2018 we'll probably reach the 1 megawatt average power level. What science? Well, we're very interested in laser. That requires high average power if you wish to do particle physics in the TV. So this, and the other one is the laser-induced fusion. And my chair says I have 2 minutes, so I'm going to pay attention to it. Give you just a bottom line summary of where we stand today on the NIF project. The NIF project was thought about by John Knuckles and John Emmett. Big lasers have been built at Livermore for 3 decades. The world's largest laser is now operating, and Ed Moses runs that project. This is about the size of your local Walmart store, 3 football fields in size, 192 beams, and they all illuminate a target that sits inside of this 30-meter diameter chamber. There's the target, 30 meters, and all the laser beams go into that and hit a target. The lasers are made of neodymium glass. They are flashlight pumped. They've operated now for a year with no damage to the laser optics and only damage to the ultraviolet optics. Here's a photograph of the chamber and the recent compressed target showing symmetrical. This slide was made a year ago. Notice the date, 3/10/2000. NIF breaks the 1 megajoule barrier. 15/2009, NIF was certified as being a completed project, having met or exceeded all of its laser parameters. Part of the world's largest laser, 4 megajoules in the infrared, 1.8. Quite reliable machine. It runs a day now for targeted data studies. The shot of day is not limited by the laser, but only by the target. Photograph of the whole round that surrounds the target. You generate X-rays of the laser going in the hole, and you illuminate the target and compress the target with a Rankine-Bach reaction. There's the target located in the center of the chamber. You get an idea. This is scale. Finally, publication this month in Science magazine on the symmetric fusion of the NIF on target. Shots taken last September. Not symmetric, tuned up, and really tuned to be a nice symmetric target with a megajoule. We are on the path to demonstrating laser-induced fusion. The goal is to do so late this year or early next year. It really will be a milestone in history when we can control the matter density and temperature. Skip through and say one of the goals for a laser scientist like myself is to think about how to build a 10 hertz NIF laser, a laser that would be pumped by diodes, not flash lamps, a laser that would operate at an energy level of 20 megawatts average power, 5 shots every second. This is an engineering project. There's nothing new that has to be invented. I'll leave you with that. I hope within a year we will bring a star to the
We have time for questions or comments.
question was, if gravitational waves are detected, will they be a low-level signal like a continuous burst? And the answer is both. Radiation that give a burst signal, and we have a team with quasi-continuous sources, neutron stars or small planets. You can tune the interferometer to be more after the instruments.
Of going to the other extreme, radiation is being utilized for support. Is that an area where you see a direct legacy from work on a conversion?
It really relates to lasers used in biology for what I'll call sensitive imaging or subwave. I think the answer is yes. There's a whole set of coherences that are being used in order to do that. When I was a young student, but that didn't talk about signal-to-noise or about nonlinearity. A nonlinear one, two-photon microbe, or improve the signal-to-noise, you can locate here. It really is a revolution in biology.